Hi, and welcome to Last Man Standing, here with me, Paul Stevenson, on Republic Broadcasting Network, your home of free speech and truth. Well, at least honesty to reach the truth, I can say certainly on this show. And I think that is the case here on RBN, which is why you should tune in. It's also why you should support us. If you go to the homepage, you can see the various donation options there. It's the best way to do it over on the right hand side. It'll give you all the options to donate. All right. This is the 29th of January. Wow, there's a month gone already in 2023. We will commence part two of a chat I did, an interview I did with the one and only Dr. Patrick Slattery tonight. And because we got talking, and we thought, let's continue and on the thread that we were on, because there's a lot to talk about. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And one of the things we did speak about, and I think this is fascinating, a lot of people that I've listened to, they can't really get their head around the UK's, the British's role in this, aggression and hostility towards Russia. And I mentioned a clip of I refer to this sort of stuff as mainstream media light. And you can listen to part one, of course, of this show, where we discuss this and give some background to it. Her name is Julia Hartley Brewer, and I think this gives a little snapshot into some of the thinking, very dangerous and I think deranged thinking that's going on in this country. So I thought it'd be worth playing that clip, Patrick. If I'm just going to play this for a minute. It's about 5 minutes long, because I thought it was a really interesting conversation. As I say, it'll give our listeners, if they're also wondering about this this mindset here in Britain, who take pride in this leading role, with Johnson going over there, of course. He went over there recently again, even though he's not even he's not even in government anymore. But let me play this for 5 minutes, and hopefully the sound quality will be okay, that you can hear it. I'm not an expert on technology, but hopefully you can pick it up okay, and then we can break it down and unpack it after the clip's finished. It's about 5 minutes.
Okay, I'd like to hear it.
Yeah.
An expert in war studies, rather more of an armchair general like myself than a real fighting man like yourself. And there seems to be this belief that actually, this dragging out the war, and as you say, enabling Ukraine to not be defeated by the Russians seems to be the aim, rather than the decision to help them get a quick victory. If we did give what President Zahawi, where that came from, President Zelensky was asking for, saying, thank you very much for the jets, but can we now have those long-range missiles, not just the medium-range missiles that took months to arrive themselves, but also the fighter jets he's been calling for since February last year? If we wanted to, we could provide that sort of hardware, and we could see the Ukrainians oust Russia from their country very quickly. Why are we not doing that?
Patrick, I'm just going to pause it there. If at any point you want to pause it, actually, because there's a few points made that we can really unpack. But even just on what she said there, give us your comments on that.
Well, so who is she addressing that to?
She's addressing that to someone she's interviewing. He's an ex military guy, I believe. He's a former chief of general staff, Lord Dannett, former chief of general staff of the British Army.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she seems to know all about weaponry and war and everything and the cost of war. She seems to really know what she's talking about. So let's hear it. Maybe I'll learn something.
Sure.
Well, I think it's very cynical, and I think it's something to be completely rejected and rubbished, the notion that it's in our Western interests to drag out the war. Frankly, it's not. We look at our own energy pricing crisis. We look at our cost of living crisis. So many negative effects on our own economy. And not entirely, but significantly attributable to the war in Ukraine. It's in our absolute best interest in the West to end this war as quickly as possible. Now, we have provided and are providing many high-tech weapons. I think the area of caution that is still there is to demonstrate to the Russians, and this is important, that our aim is to support the Ukrainians free their own territory. That is our strategic objective. it's important that the Russians don't think that, not just they don't think, that they can't tell their own people that this is some form of Western NATO plot to attack and reduce Russia. It's not in our interest to do that. It's absolutely in our interest to end the war in Ukraine and to hope that as a result of the failure of the Russian forces, there will be some form of change of leadership in Russia itself, and that a new leadership in Russia would see that actually, frankly, it's in its interest over time to reestablish a better set of relations with the West, to get sanctions taken off their economy and help their people live a better form of life. So the ultimate strategic objective must be to try and normalize relations between Western Europe and the western part of Russia.
I mean, realistically, what we really want is regime change, even though that may not be official policy. In terms of what we...
I'm going to pause it there, Patrick. I don't think that's what he meant, but he's basically saying, he's pushing back on this idea that the intention is to drag this war out. But she lets the cat out of the bag very openly there as to what she wants and what she thinks is acceptable.
I mean, it seemed to me that he was talking about the Russian people would demand new leadership.
Yeah. But she's talking about regime change.
And this is exactly, of course, what the goal has been all along. And, would I rather have people talking about it openly? The only risk of people talking about it openly is so many people might say, yeah, that's what we need.
Yes, but the reason it pricked my interest is that her assumption is, and in her hubris, is that this is okay. This is what we need. Yeah. You know. Maybe Vladimir Putin has got an issue with that. Maybe the Russian people might have an issue with that. Maybe the Russian government, the Russian military, might have an issue with that. Maybe that's got something to do with the fact that they're in Ukraine at the moment. But no, they saw what happened to Saddam Hussein, for example.
Mm-hmm. And with Muammar Gaddafi.
Yeah, so her assumption is, hell to Putin, it's just like if we want to, we go in there and get regime change, all the better. I don't even think that's what that guy was suggesting. And he should have pushed back there. He was suggesting that ultimately if the Russian people got rid of him, it would be great. But who knows to what extent she would go to for regime change. Anyway, let's continue.
Well, and you're making a good point. There is a difference between, is there a difference? Maybe it's a subtle difference between regime change and expecting the Russian people to get new leadership. How much of a difference is there? Well, I guess regime change could involve even more aggressive tactics than simply the massive sanctions that this gentleman was referring to.
Yeah, I mean, my take on what she was saying, and the distinction was that she's quite happy for a military-style regime change, whereas I don't think that's what he was suggesting. Okay. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's how I understood it.
That is the distinction. Okay, now I get it. So, because as far as I've been concerned, the whole idea was what he seemed to be referring to, this past year. Whereas if you look at Saddam Hussein, you look at Muammar Gaddafi, you had in the case of Iraq, you had the country actually occupied. And in the case of Libya, I guess there wasn't a whole lot of Western troops, boots on the ground. Maybe there weren't any, maybe there were some, but there was a whole bunch of Western wings in the air.
Yeah, exactly. I think, like I said, it really illuminates and encapsulates this hubris that goes around that, we can go around removing people if we want, regardless, and that Putin should just stand back and allow that. Anyway, let's continue.
This is Chancellor Two Tanks, just 14. Look, 14 isn't going to change the what happens in the outcome of this war. There's all these Leopard Two Tanks are basically fit because the sheer number they're available, because it's made in Germany, available in Europe, easier to train on, they're fast, they're lighter, perhaps easier and quicker for the Ukrainian forces to train on them. Are we making enough of a contribution, or is it our contribution in a lot of ways, not just the financial help and the military hardware, leading the way, bringing America with us, bringing our NATO allies with us when we've got countries like Germany that have been dragging their feet for pretty much the entire last year?
That'll give you a good snapshot into the British thinking at the minute in terms of, I suppose, the privileged middle classes or upper middle classes of which she is part. Her listeners are not part of that, but that's the thinking. You know, she at least states the position largely of the political class, of the media in this country, just what she said right there.
Sorry. I had a question. Her accent, right? I used to watch this lady on BBC. She was a news presenter. She was a reporter and a news presenter. And 20 years ago, she was, you know, youngish and kind of cute. I forgot her first name. Her last name was Llewellyn. You know, it's a Welsh name. And she had I don't know if you know who I'm talking about.
Don't think I do, actually.
Yeah, and they had similar voice, except the Llewellyn lady. I don't know if you'd say her accent was posher or what. But the thing is, in Britain, you know, not only do you have the regional accents, but you have these really distinct class accents. And that woman who was speaking, class-wise, I mean, that's not a working class accent, right? So
no, it's not. But most of her listeners would be sort of more working class people. And I think her taking the whole thing, and when you hear some of the responses that come in by text messages, that come in by email, would show that divide that we've spoken about again, the difference between, you know, as I say, she represents the media class, she represents the upper middle class. And they have an attitude of entitlement to a lot of things. Julia does talk some sense on other topics, but it's her foundational, it's the foundation of who she is. This woman will live in a sort of a gated community somewhere or a very nice, part of Surrey in some very nice area. But it really, I just wanted your comments on you thought. Of how she, you know, she's really taking credit for they're even pulling America into this and how they, you know, they've been taking a leading role and the Germans have been dragging their heels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a hyper aggressivity to that, hyper aggression. It's just bizarre. I can't wrap my mind around it. I can definitely wrap my mind around Victoria Nuland with this ethnic grudge. But I can understand, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago, the Cold War mindset, because the Soviet Union under communism, there had been, a lot of nasty things that occurred. And even though I was not a Cold Warrior, I wasn't a Cold Warrior because I was a little bit more tuned in on what was going on at the time, which was just kind of mundane, you know, run of the mill oppression. And the people who were big Cold Warriors were probably more aware of what had happened historically. And so they were very alarmed. But why would a Briton, upper class or working class or whatever, why would somebody, you know, they don't have a traditional ethnic grudge with Russia, and this Russia doesn't represent, you know, a kind of tyranny, the likes of which humanity had never known before. It's baffling to me. Maybe like in America, there was a kind of patriotism that people my age grew up with, a boomer patriotism, America never lost a war, and we're always the good guys, World War II, we're always the good guys, the, you know, better dead than red, and all of this stuff that kind of still translates to Russia somehow. I don't know if Britain, post-World War II, Britain had the same kind of jingoism, you know, they just lost an empire. It's just bizarre. I can understand the Jewish ethnic animosity, but I just can't understand why somebody from her class, from her social group, what would motivate them other than they've been totally socialized into these Jewish priorities?
That's a big part of it, and also arrogance. And also, I think that she's a bit cringe, and it's like she likes to, portray herself as sort of a woman of the people. I think she thinks it's what people want to hear. I think she still thinks that Russia is the Soviet Union. She hasn't done any research on the background of the situation over there in Ukraine with Russia. Nothing, I don't think, because I don't see how you could have her views if you did. And like you said, I think someone from her class system, they've been through other more mainstream media, and this is the attitude. I mean, they hate Russia. They buy into it all, and then she scratches her head when her listeners are saying things very differently. But we'll continue. It's only another, I think, about 2 minutes, I think.
Well, I think the UK has played a really important role as cheerleader, and as has been the orchestra, the conductor, if you like, of the Western NATO orchestra of support to Ukraine. And I think credit to Boris Johnson for starting that, and credit to Rishi Sunak for continuing it. We're giving 14 Challenger tanks, but actually the whole package of support that the UK is giving is significant and will play into the overall increasing capability that the Ukrainians have got to enable them at some point in the future, and I stress at some point, to be able to launch a counter-offensive. And I think one thing that politicians and the media and commentators like me have got to become increasingly savvy about is it's not in the Ukrainians' interest for us to tot up mathematically just how many tanks they've got, how soon they will be ready, because from an operational point of view, we've got to achieve, or the Ukrainians have got to be helped to achieve, some degree of surprise on the battlefield. So their capability needs to be built up. They're going to have to withstand an almost inevitable Russian new offensive at some point in the late winter, early spring, which on the evidence of everything we've seen will fail. And then after that, at some point, the Ukrainians have got to launch this counteroffensive with the equipment that we're giving them. So we don't want to be too specific, and I'm going to stop being specific about how much, what, where, and when.
It's a very, very good point.
They've got to build some operational surprise.
Indeed. It was a very good point there. Can I ask you, a lot of people, and I'm accusing me of being a warmonger for saying I think we should aid Ukraine. A lot of people still saying this could escalate to World War III. You know, that's a big concern for a lot of German people who are very much opposed to this, their Leopard 2 tanks going directly to Ukraine. A lot of people are saying, look, you know, this is Europe and NATO's fault for sort of enticing Ukraine to the West when they were in Russia's sphere of influence. That wasn't the deal when we had the security agreement over Ukraine's future when they removed their nuclear weapons, and that actually we kind of brought it on ourselves and we should just leave them to it and let Russia take Ukraine. What do you make of that?
Well, we are well beyond the point of let Russia take Ukraine. Ukraine has stood up for itself. We have supported Ukraine to stand firm. And that's a really important point of international law. Ukraine is a sovereign country. That's agreed by international order. And therefore, it has every right to defend of its own territory. And Zelensky is right to demand that it comes back, including Crimea. I think the wider point is that we've got to keep saying that that is our objective. It is to stand up for international law. It is to stand up for the Ukrainian people's right to choose their way of life and to live in every square kilometre of the country that is legally theirs. But
when you say every square kilometre, are you including Crimea?
Well, that's what President Zelensky has said.
Yeah.
And it was taken, Crimea was taken from Ukraine illegally in 2014. Yeah, we huffed and puffed in 2014, but frankly, the West's response was fairly weak as far as that's concerned, which is one of the reasons why President Putin was emboldened to attack further on the 24th of February last year. But the language that we ought to be using is to be talking about this being a limited war. There is a concept of limited war, limited by means, limited by geography, and hopefully limited by time. And if we start to use the language of limited war, yes, we're going to support the Ukrainians to win in Ukraine, but Russia's got to start to believe that we have no aspirations to neutralize Russia, to run Russia down, to break the Russian economy. We just want to support the Ukrainians, their right to live in their own country, every square kilometre of it.
Lord Dannett, always so good to talk to you, sir. Former Chief of the General Staff of the British Army, of course, really appreciate you joining us. Lots of texts and tweets coming in answer to that first question I put to him. How far should Britain go to help Ukraine defeat Russia? Make this, we should have nothing to do with it. Charlie, yay, war, escalation, madness. Kathy says, though long-range weapons are a no-brainer, I don't understand the foot-dragging. Nobody's asking British soldiers to fight Ukraine. Zelensky's been very clear that's not what he's asking for. Ukraine is losing lives every day. They just want weapons, for pity's sake. Ben says, Russia will never be defeated. We should all know that. Yeah, everyone said that Ukraine was going to lose the war within a matter of weeks. That didn't happen. Dan says, shouldn't be helping them at all. It's nothing to do with us. Mark says, I think we've done enough. How about sorting our own country out now? Rudy, we should all stop all involvement immediately. Benny says about time for peace talks rather than just wanting to escalate the violence. And that's obviously not what the West wants, just more violence. I'm always fascinated, Benedict, that people have this view. I don't understand it. I don't know how much of this is Russian bots. I don't know how much of this is, you know, conspiracy theorists on the internet. I'm not remotely a warmonger. I'm the opposite warmonger. I want people in Ukraine to live in peace. I don't think Ukraine's a perfect country. I don't think Zelensky's a perfect leader. People don't have to be perfect to want to be able to live in a democratically free country without a Russian invading force.
I think a lot of people always forget that the world won't just leave you alone if you say, I'm not interested. That's the, you know, the, if you think that Russia will just stop at Ukraine and go, oh, that's fine, that's all the territory we wanted. A bit like, you know, the Nazis, oh, we just want the Sudetenland. It's not all of Czechoslovakia. Oh, it's not Poland. It's not France. Oh, yeah, that's the point. If you think China would just stop at Taiwan, given the fact that it is already occupying two other sovereign countries at the moment, it's that idea that you can just, and it is, you know, it's a very Anglo-Saxon idea, because we see it a lot in America with the right in America. Yeah. No, we want no intervention. We want no more boys going overseas. Exactly. If you are going to be a leading power, you have responsibilities to at least keep yourself as a leading power. Yeah. To do that, you need to face off against these people.
If Russia wins in Ukraine, they will march into Poland next and the Baltic states. Those are NATO allies who we are pledged to defend. Mm. We'll just be fighting it somewhere else, and then we will have to send our own men.
And China will invade Taiwan if it is emboldened.
Absolutely. I don't understand what people are thinking.
And then South Korea.
Exactly. 8:20 is the time. We'll have to leave it there. This is Talk Breakfast.
So it's the domino theory. Oh, today Ukraine, tomorrow the world. I mean, it's clownish and cartoonish.
It is.
He said that China was already occupying two sovereign countries. What's he talking about? I guess he's trying to call Tibet and Xinjiang, maybe. But
are you still with me, Patrick? The connection lost you there.
Suzerainty. Yeah.
So I just repeat that, Patrick, because I lost you there for a second.
Oh, I'm sorry. So China, what two countries is he talking about? Is he saying they're illegally occupying Tibet, which was always recognized as part of the Chinese Empire? Inside China, it had a status of suzerainty, which is something, the concept that's no longer in international law, but suzerainty was always subject, it was always subordinate to the Chinese emperor. And I guess he's talking with the other one. What's he talking about? Xinjiang, which that was never an internationally recognized country. It's always been part of China. I mean, you can go back to the Arabian Nights, which were written many hundreds of years ago. And the story of Aladdin, where did that take place? That took place in China. It's said to have taken place in China. But it was the Muslim part of China. It took place in Xinjiang. But you know, they describe it as China. So it's...
And also, yeah, I mean, they talked about Crimea there as well. And, you know, and Lavrov, because they say it's illegal. Lavrov is correctly, to my understanding, corrected this by saying that, and it's the same in the Donbass region, that they were supposed to treat the people in the east of Ukraine the same way, that it's an international law, that every citizen deserves the same rights, the same religious rights, the same, you know, rights across the board. And the people in the Donbass and the Crimea, because of the fact that many of them are, most of them are Russian speaking and are part of the Orthodox Church, not the Ukrainian Church, and they speak Russian, have the right to self-determination. And that the government wasn't representing them, and far from it, they were persecuting them and bombing them for years. And Russia went in there and let them have the right of self-determination by allowing them to vote. And they overwhelmingly voted to be part of Russia. They ignore that. This part of international law, they don't recognize. But I thought there's a lot to unpack there, but I thought it gave a good snapshot into the Gulf. Mm-hmm. The absolute gulf in the mindset, and this idea that Russia, again, she insults Russia, and oh, by the way, she insults anybody who disagrees with her, because she says tough when us, as she refers to it, as, you know, as he said, Anglo-Saxons and those libertarian Americans who want to be isolationists when it comes to these things, you know, we say it's nothing to do with us, the callers, you heard them, we want peace, it's time to negotiate peace, we've got our own problems. Her attitude is tough. We have no choice. We have to face this tyranny over there, or it'll be here. And this is the same Russia that she also, like I said, reckoned earlier in the interview that were foraging in the forest for food when they first went into Ukraine. So inept, so underfunded. And all sorts of insults towards Russia. I mean, which one is it? How can you be so useless and so inept, and your economy be so terrible with, you know, and at the same time take over all of Russia? I don't think these people ever sit down and do any real thinking, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to jump on the Ukraine for a second. The Crimean Peninsula, Crimea. So Crimea really historically does not have any connection with Ukraine, the Ukrainian people.
No, not at all.
Not at all. That's very artificial. Other than Russia, who does it have a connection with? Well, the Ottoman Turks, the Mongols. You know, the Mongols are the forerunners of the Tartars. You know, the Mongols and the Tartars and the Golden Horde. They ruled over Russia for a while, or had Russia as in a state of suzerainty, but Ukraine never did. The only reason, and I have an old encyclopedia, the atlas that was part of the encyclopedia that I grew up with, which was published in the early 1950s. You look at the map there, and it shows, you know, the map of the Soviet Union, and Crimea was part of the Russian Republic, not part of the Ukrainian Republic. And in the mid-50s, it just got transferred over to Ukraine to commemorate the 200th anniversary of something I can't even remember, nothing that anybody in America's ever heard of. The transfer was just part of some internal Soviet politics. Khrushchev, who was an ethnic Russian, but an ethnic Russian from the Donbass, and he had spent time as under Stalin. He had been the boss of the Ukrainian Communist Party. Ukrainians were always overrepresented in the Soviet leadership. Brezhnev, who was the leader for almost two decades, he was Ukrainian. Gorbachev was half Ukrainian. It's not as if the Ukrainians were some sort of dispossessed minority in Russia. So they wound up with, as some sort of birthday present, they wound up with Crimea during the last, 25 years or 35 years of the Soviet Union. Crimea had been incorporated into the Ukrainian Republic, but it didn't have Ukrainians in it, very few Ukrainians. And so when the Soviet Union was breaking up, the Crimeans, and Crimea was an autonomous region within, actually, I think it was called an autonomous republic within Ukraine, and their assembly voted for independence in 1992, right after the breakup of the Soviet Union.
and that independence wound up, that independence declaration wound up getting frozen, but they never wanted to be part of the independent Ukraine. And then, you know, if you're going to talk about legality, what was the legality of the State Department overthrowing the government of the constitutionally elected president of Ukraine? And so what happened then is
what was the legality of bombing Kosovo? What was the legality of invading Iraq? The list could go on and on.
Yeah, if the autonomous region of Kosovo could be amputated from Serbia, well, that sets a precedent. And the thing about Crimea is they're after the illegal coup in Kiev, the Crimean assembly voted for independence from Ukraine. And then as an independent state, they applied for membership in the Russian Federation. So, you know, if you want to question the legality of it and everything, question it, but the case for Crimea being part of Ukraine, legally, internationally, legally part of Ukraine, it's certainly not open and shut.
Yeah, and she made the point, and people are always making this point, and the ex-military guy there made it more gently, I suppose, and more cautiously when it came to she's very aggressive towards Russia. I think she thinks she's dog-whistling to her listeners, but, you know, her listeners want nothing to do with this, and rightly so. But he was saying that it's important that the Russians know that we're only trying to help the Ukrainians defend themselves. And we're not trying to, you know, undermine Russia too much. He said, you know, what we need is regime change. I think military, as we mentioned. But the fact of the matter is, you have an illegal. See, they talk about legality. There was a coup there in 2014, put in by a hostile government. They ignored the Minsk agreements. I don't see how that's legal. I think that was actually, I think that was backed by the UN as well. It wasn't just Germany and the French said they would back this. I think that was brought to the UN and rubber stamped there. So if you have now a hostile nation in Kiev, which is a threat to the Russian Federation, well, okay, Ukraine has a right to defend itself against an invading force, I guess. But if that Ukraine is an existential threat or is perceived as an existential threat by its neighbor, then I think it's fair game to Russia to go in there and protect it. So, I mean, it's this usual double standards and this hubris from the West. We will do what we want. And if anybody else tries to protect themselves, they're tyrants. You know, it's illegal. Blah, blah, blah. But the reason I played it anyway was to give a snapshot, because I've heard a few people say, why are the British so involved in this and pushing it, and, you know, not only pushing it, but they're proud to push it. You know, it's a mixture of things, but I thought we would, elaborate it more here on part two of our interview here tonight, Patrick, you know?
Yeah.
One other thing she did say, by the way, which is, and I think they cut it out of there, maybe someone reprimanded her for, maybe she got so much stick, was that she said, the Germans have been dragging their heels using this excuse for guilt, you know, because of the Nazis and what they did to Russians. But personally, I think, let's face it, the truth is that really all they want is they want their cheap natural gas from Russia to keep flowing and to avoid going to war with Germany. I mean, it's staggering. It's just, to me, that's deranged. I mean, imagine that. Instead of having a good partnership where you've got cheap oil and natural gas and you can heat your homes and put fuel in your car, you know, you, it's better to go to war with them and have your children die. I mean, it's crazy.
So a lot of people have a lot at stake. And she really doesn't have anything at stake. For her, it's just kind of like, well, she can virtue signal as a good person. And, she'll say things like, all they're asking is for us to send weapons. We don't have to, you know, no troops are, they're not asking to send troops. Well, okay, so what kind of...
The Ukrainians die.
Yeah, the Ukrainians, right? Zelensky, of course, Zelensky sooner or later is going to ask for that, but
you know, that's this.
No,
is
but I mean, separate. You know,
he's only asking for the weaponry so he can defend his own country. Nobody's talking about sending British troops. Well, okay, so who's doing the suffering? It's people, yeah. It's people on the other side of the continent. It's people on the right. other side of Europe who are suffering. She's not risking anything, and yet she's so cavalier about this.
Yeah, exactly. If you really feel so strongly about Russia, then call for a full war and we need to send our troops in there if you feel that strongly about it. And as I say, she mocked the Germans facetiously and sarcastically saying they say it's this, World War II guilt, but really it's because they want the cheap natural gas to come. And really it's because they want to avoid a war with Germany. Imagine that, Patrick. You want to have a good trading relationship and avoid a war with Russia. I mean, it's just, as I say, it's deranged. I couldn't believe my ears, really. But as you say, she's got no skin in the game.
She does
a nice little.
She's risking nothing. Our people in the United States are risking nothing. Everybody is so gung ho on it. On nationalbugle.com today, I belatedly, or perhaps repeat, maybe for the second time, I published the list of congressmen who had opposed one of the early giant aid packages to Ukraine. It was only 9 or 10 people out of 435. Only 9 or 10. And everybody else is all gung-ho for this. And, of course, in the case of the United States, over the past several years, even like budgetary concerns have become nothing. Especially during the corona apocalypse, the printing presses, it's just you print money. You can just send money anywhere. It doesn't have to, you don't even have to raise it through taxes. There's no tax raise. I remember in the first Gulf War, one of the things the first President Bush was praised for was he was able to, win the war without actually spending any money, supposedly, because he got Japan and Germany to cough up, like $20 billion or something. And so supposedly, that's what paid for the operation. So the
connection there for a second, Patrick, but you were just referring or talking about.
Is the recording still going?
Yes, we're still recording, and we can continue now. I think you were just talking about, we were talking about those who've got no skin in the game, you know, including this, if you could call her a radio host. She's just one of the most odious individuals.
Right. Did you hear me rant about the first Gulf War and President Bush?
No, but you were, if you can get to that next, it was interesting to hear what you were saying about on nationalbugle.com. It's a website.
That's my website. And I don't update it often enough, but I did put on a list of the, it was about 10 Republican congressmen who had opposed, not the most recent, but one of the early big ones, aid packages to Ukraine. Only 10 out of 435 members of the House of Representatives. I mean, everybody's gung-ho for this, but they, you know, there's no sacrifice. Americans aren't really being asked to make any sacrifice. Well, there's inflation. Of course, there was already inflationary pressure because of the retarded coronavirus response, but they're really not being asked for any kind of sacrifice. And you know, in particular, the upper class, the only people who are feeling pain are people who are suffering through inflation, and inflation is tougher on people, you know, retired people with fixed incomes or, you know, working class people. It's tough on them. And it just reminds me of the first Gulf War, where President Bush was able to have his glorious war, the first President Bush, his glorious war without even a tax hike, because he was able to get the Germans and the Japanese to send like $15 billion each or something, and he used that money. And so, yeah, I think the Japanese might have had to hike their sales tax by 1 or 2%. So they were making a little bit of a sacrifice. No sacrifice was being made by
you know, the American people, although honestly, all these wars, there is a sacrifice and the entire country is being destroyed. It's not entirely because of the wars, but that plays a part, but people don't see that.
No, I totally agree. They, as you say, it's like they don't see it. And, you know, as long as it's not affecting, you know, me, and as long as it's over there, it's fine. But, you know, this could be, you know, it could be coming to you. I mean, I was thinking about this last night. If there was American or British body bags coming back, and it fills me with dread because I've got a 19-year-old son, Julia Hartley Brewer, I think, has got two daughters. And she reckons she's a, this is the other thing, she reckons she's a conservative and, you know, who's paying for this money we're sending over to Ukraine? But anyway, you know, I've got a 19-year-old son and it fills me with dread that we would send soldiers over there. But, if people were suffering that, it's a mixed bag, I think, because you would have, okay, now we are suffering, but would that increase patriotism or would that say we want an end to it? I think maybe like if Vietnam's anything to go by, it could increase the patriotism for a short while.
I think when you have, I don't know, maybe when you have people you don't know, your fellow countrymen you don't know dying, it can be, well, we can't let their, you know, we can't let their loss be in vain. But when it's somebody that you do know, then the actual price, not just the symbolic price, but the actual price, it becomes a lot more tangible. And, you know, in Vietnam, I was too young to have my classmates going. But people a few years older than me, they were seeing their classmates. I mean, I don't know if it's true, but I heard that you had, the recruiting officers, the draft officers, they were just drafting people like right out of their high school, graduation ceremonies. It probably wasn't right out of the ceremonies, but it's probably close enough. And so, you know, people were going over and even if they weren't dying, and of course, you know, 54,000, 57,000 Americans wound up dying over there, even if they weren't dying.
But by the way,
back as drug addicts.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It took, what, how long was the Vietnam War? 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, it went on for a long time. And the beginning and the end were kind of amorphous. It's hard to say when it began and when it ended.
Yeah.
But the real escalation took place in 1965. And so you had, and the draft itself, did it end in 1973? So you might have had about 8 years of, you know, serious, you know, in, what, conscripted troops going over. Serious numbers.
So in 10 years, there's 55,000 died in 1 year. And it's according to various open sources, including Ursula von der Leyen, and let the cat out of the bag, that there's already 100,000 Ukrainian soldiers have died. And that was a month ago. And 35,000 missing in action. And they reckon there's probably about, you know, in total, probably maybe 25,000 Russians dead. I mean, this is a lot of dead bodies, you know. I mean, this is horrendous, you know. It's really serious, and it's an absolute crime. And it just fills me full of dread that this thing's going to spread. But already 122,000 Ukrainian soldiers dead. It's staggering to get your head around that, you know.
It's enormous. And, you know, Zelensky in particular, his tactics, are to just defend land, defend this village at any cost. His priorities seem to be, propaganda. It seems to be that he wants to show that, you know, how, well, he's willing to make these massive sacrifices of humanity in order to then come to the United States Congress and be able to say the people of Bakhmut, they are swimming in blood, but they don't give up. And it's all for propaganda.
They don't give up because you're forcing them out there in horrendous conditions, and if they don't go out, then the Ukrainian secret police will kill them.
And, you know, a lot of the people who are dying, I said in our show yesterday or the previous show that in general it's men in their 20s fighting wars. In Ukraine, they're sending middle-aged men. And I don't know exactly what's going on. I think to an extent some of the younger, more able-bodied people, men, have been marshaled. They've been held back so that they can be trained and that you can have some sort of effective force for the future. I think, I'm not sure of this, but I think a lot of the dead, compared to other wars, are disproportionately, you know, people who are 30s, 40s, and 50s. A lot of older men.
I've heard reports that they're scraping the barrel so badly that they're sending teenagers and even people with disabilities if they can fight at all. And I mean, the whole thing's just disgusting. And on that point, how many Ukrainians are actually still there? I saw a clip today on a YouTube site giving some footage. I think it was Ukrainians fleeing Solodar or somewhere in that region in the east of in the Donbass region in the east. Solodar is a very important strategic place near Bakhmut, which, by the way, has now officially fallen. The Ukraine defense sources have now confirmed Solodar has fallen to the Russians. Of course, they. For a few days, the Ukrainians denied that when the Russians first claimed it. But they, the clip that I saw, it wasn't, when they were fleeing, it wasn't the Ukrainian I heard. It was a guy from East London. I know that accent. He said, we'll get him next time. We'll get him next time, lads. This is a squaddy. This was a guy from East London. Driving this tank when they were fleeing.
Did you say a squatty?
Yeah, I don't know if maybe English people don't call them squatties. Maybe it's a pejorative because I'm from Northern Ireland, because obviously we fought the British Army in Northern Ireland, the Irish Catholic side, the Irish Nationalists. But he's a British soldier, and he was driving, and he obviously seemed to have some leadership because he said, "We'll get him next time." And so I've also heard reports from, it was one of the Chechenian guys. He said at the beginning of the war, when we're interception radio, conversations and everything else, it was mostly Ukrainians. Now he says it's British accents, it's American accents and language, it's Polish accents. Mm-hmm. Now, how many, I mean, there's a massive loss there. Again, this is into serious proportions of deaths of young Ukrainian men already.
And of course, we have to remind people that the president of Ukraine and so much of his government, they're Jews. And the Jews have historically, the Jews and the Slavs, whether you're talking about Ukrainians or Poles or Russians, they don't have the best of relations. The Jews tend to see these Slavs as enemies. And so, is it heroic for Zelensky to be sacrificing so many Ukrainians? He's not sacrificing his own people. Would he be sacrificing so many Jews? Didn't he let the Jews leave the country before the war, before he started drafting everybody? He did. And then you look at our government in the United States, which is a Jewish government. It's a Jewish occupied government. It's not Zog, it's Jog. And they're trying to tranify us. They're trying to overwhelm us with mass immigration. They're doing all sorts of things to us. Would they care if just, countless thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of our troops were dying? I mean, they don't care about people dying from the deadly vax.
No. By the way, talking about Jews, the Israelis have come out and denied or refused to send any more weapons or refused any more support for Ukraine at the moment and have resisted American pressure, apparently. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't know how much truth there is to that, but I read that in an article today. So, yeah.
And they were reluctant to get involved in this in their last government under Bennett and who's the other guy? And now Netanyahu, he's reluctant to get involved in it. And, you know, it's not that they're good, they have good intentions. I would guess, my guess is that.
Good instincts.
Netanyahu in particular, he doesn't want to be the world distracted by Ukraine and Russia. He wants to go to war with Iran. He wants to see Iran obliterated. Mm-hmm. Russia's not really on his, you know, Russia is a big, I've always thought it's a bigger boogeyman for the diaspora in America than it is for the Israelis. The Israelis probably do a lot of good business. You know, there's so many Russian speaking Israelis. They probably do good business with Russia. It's a lot closer there. It's their target is Iran. This is, you know, it's not as if they like Russian people or anything, but they've got their priorities, and their priorities, I believe, is Iran.
Yeah, and also I think they recognize that this might not go the way the West is planning, and they'll wait and see, and they don't want to be, you know, on the wrong side of history here, just in case, because these people are obsessed with their interests and their security, you know, and all the rest of it. And they know that Putin essentially, you know, prevented them from overthrowing Assad in Syria. So I thought it was interesting as well. We can talk about that another time. So anyway, you know, I think more and more people are becoming aware this is a proxy war against Russia. They, in all likelihood, the idea is to drag it out as long as possible in an attempt to drain the resources of Russia. Where do you, I know it's a broad question, but after the tanks were sent in, Kiev was hit by 55 missiles today. Don't think that's any coincidence. The Ukrainians have claimed 47 of them were shot down, but I mean, I think the regime there in Kiev, their record and capacity for lies and propaganda, I think you can take that with a pinch of salt. So Russia immediately upped the ante today in their attacks. There was also some other, they also struck Odessa. These strikes took place. Yeah, there was, Odessa was struck, I think, with three missiles today as well. Most of them were launched, the attacks from the Black Sea, but also from Tu-95 warplanes. I think they're actually, you know, those bombers. But where do you see this ultimately going? Do you see Russia, if it gets dragged into this where it goes on for 2, 3, 4 years? Can you see it going that long?
Well, how much time do we have in this show?
We've got about, let me see. I think we've got about 20 minutes.
You think so?
Maybe not. I don't know. Let me check.
I don't think. Yeah, you check. Honestly, I don't think it's going on for that much longer. I suppose it could go on longer. You know, the more weaponry and NATO commitment and whatnot, the more there is, then the longer it can go on. But my guess is that it's sometime this year, probably maybe the first half of this year, we're going to see Zelensky lose power. My guess is he'll leave the country. He'll be pushed out of office. That there are going to be people in, especially in the Ukrainian military, who are going to be sick of seeing their soldiers, their men die. Their men are dying. They're going to get sick of this. The longer this goes on, the more territory they lose. And I think there would be some who would just be willing to settle with losing using these largely Russian-speaking areas of Donbass, Zaporozhye, Kherson, Kharkov, Odessa, Mykolaiv, they'd be willing to just say, okay, we'll cut our losses, and those aren't really our people anyway. You know, for these really chauvinistic Ukrainians, they're not losing that many people. They'll have a more pure
Ukraine.
Yeah, a more homogeneous Ukraine that based in Kiev and the area towards Russia, Galicia. That's kind of where I see it. And I don't know if Putin and the Russian government have like very, very strict objectives. I think there's probably a range of things they would accept. But that's basically where I see it.
Okay. Well, actually, yeah, I think, let me see. I was, you're right. We had last time. I think we've only got maybe about 5 minutes left, Patrick. So any final thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, I've been pretty reasonably optimistic the whole time. This is horrible what's happening. I do think it's going to be a very substantial defeat for the Jewish dominated oligarchy that rules the United States and so much of Europe. I don't think it's going to be a death blow for them, but I think it's going to severely weaken their positions both domestically and internationally. You're going to have an international system that is going to start gravitating towards a Russia-China axis.
Already is.
Yeah, in terms of economics, international institutions. And then domestically, I think it's, you know, if you look at United States, it's going to be one more disaster. And who knows? I mean, so far they've been able to have disaster after disaster. And I was looking at this meme today where they show some, you know, fat American cartoon meme, and he's watching TV, and it, you know, you can see through the windows of his house, black riots and gay pride parades. And what was the other thing? I don't know if it was vaxxers or wars or what. And then on TV, it had, you know, it had like the Fox News logos on it. And the Happy Merchant was saying, it's a Chinese goyim. And that's how it's been working. So, you know, you would like to think that there are, that people would connect dots, but I don't know. I mean, either you could have a situation where somebody like Kanye West points out that not only is the emperor naked, but he's molesting our children, or you could have somebody like Tucker Carlson saying, you know, it was the Chinese all along, and I don't know which way it'll go.
Well, we can observe and watch and see, Patrick. Thank you very much for joining me, and we can do it again soon, obviously. And have a good week. Keep in touch. All right, folks, I'll be back again next Sunday. So what's that, the 5th or the 6th of February? Until then, take care and God bless.